This podcast is for entertainment purposes only and does not replace your own financial, tax, legal, or financial product advice.
Before we start today's episode, I'm doing Glenn's Investing Night School. This is a once-off session. It's in November next month. And what we're doing is, it's for beginner investors. So if you are interested in learning about the concepts of investing, what the share market is, how it works, how to place trades, whether I need a micro investing platform, whether I need a brokerage account, why I should have to diversify, what's a managed fund, what's direct shares, what's an ETF, everything. It's for beginners. It's $55. It's once off only. And if you do purchase this, you'll have a month to watch it. So if you can't make it on the night, you'll get a month to watch it, and then it will be removed from the ether. I'm looking forward to joining you, and we'll have a lot of fun. I'm doing it in front of a live audience in my house, so at least I'll be able to interact with faces, because then I'll know the beginners in person whether I'm making sense to them, and we can dig deeper. So that will be a good litmus test for me in the room. There's a link in the show notes. Looking forward to seeing you at Glenn's Investing Night School. I've got Alex Vikovich, who is the wealth editor at the Australian Financial Review, to have a chat with me today. Alex, g'day, how are you?
G'day, Glenn. I'm well, thanks, mate. And thanks for having me on a podcast, bit of a newfangled medium for newspaper men like myself.
But, yeah, that's right. Yes, yes. Now, I thought I would give everybody a bit of a background for Alex. Now, in 2016, he was living in the States. He covered the 2016 election. He lived in DC, Austin. He worked for a congressman. So, he kind of knows, right? And we're going to have a bit of a chat about the election stuff, what it means for markets, what it means for our money. But before we do that, Alex, can you tell us about what you're working on at the AFR?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, thanks, mate, for allowing a plug at the outset. And look, really, as I'm guessing you guys have spoken about on this program, and I know you've been talking about this kind of new influx of investors into the market, you know, the Robin Hood phenomenon that we're seeing around the world. And really interestingly, we're kind of seeing that not just from the ASX's kind of data that they're putting out, which is fascinating, right? Showing, you know, more women investors, many more investors under 40 just in the last 6 months participating on the ASX. But interestingly, our own data has picked up a lot of that, and we are seeing a boom in subscriptions at the Fin Review from people in younger demographics. And so, you know, we did have a kind of idea for some time that we need to be speaking more specifically to this audience and maybe trying to, you know, cast off the boomer imagery. You know, our investing sort of content is very much aimed, as I'm sure you'll agree, Glenn, at that self-managed super fund kind of boomer retiree audience. And we do that very well, and we have for a long time, and that works well for our kind of Saturday paper audience. But we've got this you know, kind of new and really engaged audience of young investors. And so I'm heading up this new project called Wealth Generation. We're in the fourth week. You've already featured in there once, mate, so that's a pretty good strike rate so far. And yeah, look, lots of ways we can work with the My Millennial Money community, hopefully. And the idea is just for it to be a bit of an entry point, I guess, to some of our other content that maybe is a bit intimidating at first, you know, some of the deep investigations, some of the like daily markets coverage. But I guess to be a bit more explanational and just sort of a bit more normal in the way that people of our generation speak, right? So hopefully we're getting that balance right. It's a weekly newsletter that goes out every Wednesday. So yeah, they can check it out at afr.com and hopefully just follow their way through ads to Wealth Generation.
Love it. So there you go. Now, straight to it, the US election. So at the time of recording, it's the 26th of October. And I like to just put the date in there because things could change tomorrow. One of the candidates could drop dead tomorrow. anything can happen. Now,
well, if it was going to happen, it probably would have happened a week ago.
So. Yeah, that's right. So there you go. Now, the election's coming up. And this podcast, it's more about the politics of it and how it impacts everyone's life. We're not going to get too much into the dollar side. But I guess why are people so worried about investment markets off the back of a US election?
Look, it's a tough one. I'm always of two minds when it comes to American politics at the moment, because on the one hand, you know, there are a lot of unprecedented elements to what we're going through. Donald Trump is a truly different type of president and a truly different type of candidate than we've ever seen. And that obviously feeds into, you know, the kind of toxic social media culture that we're in, and the mainstream media has a total frenzy with that. And so, of course, we're in a global pandemic. So all those elements do make it unprecedented. But at the same time, you do have, you know, one of the most sophisticated democracies in the world that has a long history of patterns when it comes to electoral politics. And the question is the extent to which that will go towards plan and history will be repeated, or the extent to which this is really, really is unprecedented. And to be honest, I think, you know, I kind of go between those two spheres when I'm looking at the election. Some days I think, you know, this is not as crazy as the media is making out. The normal kind of patterns and the normal tribalism that you see in any country will ultimately play out, and normal history will repeat itself. And under normal history, a term president would almost always win a second term. Very, very unusual for that not to occur, particularly when, you know, the Republicans have only been in power for 4 years and we had 8 years of Democratic rule before that. So it's almost unprecedented for a first term president from one side to be knocked out. But then again, we are in very unusual times. And one of the reasons that markets are really paying attention, I think, this time is ordinarily markets are backing an incumbent, right? So ordinarily, markets investors don't like change, right? But in 2016, we saw that markets didn't really know how to react. And often markets also back a Republican because quite simply, if you're going to get policies like lower tax rates, if you are going to get more of a free market enterprise approach from the administration, then that's usually good for equity markets, right? And so you usually will get a bounce from a Republican win, but that's not what we saw in 2016 in the immediate aftermath, partly because Hillary Clinton was expected to win, but also because Hillary Clinton was seen as the continuity candidate, not the change candidate, because we'd had Obama before that and because we kind of knew what to expect with Hillary Clinton. You know, she'd been in the White House before, albeit as the First Lady. She was, you know, really well known what her policies are, and she's been in government a long time, whereas Trump was the more erratic candidate, even though he was a Republican and even though his policy agenda on the economic side was sort of a tried and tested pro-markets agenda. We still saw some sort of, you know, market spiral in those first couple of days. So this time around, it's really hard for, I think, investors to work out who the change candidate is and who the continuity candidate is, because while Trump is the incumbent, he's so erratic, right, that it's not really a continuity candidate, because he can backflip on policies and he can move markets very quickly with a tweet, and he does all sorts of things on the economic front that, on the one hand, are good for markets, right? I mean, the tax cuts that he's introduced have overwhelmingly sort of supported equity market, certainly in the US. But at the same time, he's got, you know, a raging trade war with China, and it's not clear the extent to which Joe Biden would change that or really be counter to that. And of course, it's very difficult for real policy debates to be listened to in this current climate. So, look, absolutely. I think there's a lot of focus. Yeah, yeah. It's been difficult for 10 years to get policy debates into the news cycle. But I think, you know, particularly so at the moment, because Trump is so good at controlling the cycle with the things that he's saying and with rhetoric. So, look, I think there is a lot of focus, because people really don't know what's going to happen, right? And I've seen widely different surveys from groups of investors about what's going to happen. At the moment, you know, Biden is still tipped in the polls to win this thing, but the polls are really narrowing in a lot of key battleground states as we speak. By the time this comes out on Thursday, I reckon they will have narrowed further still.
Yeah.
And then the bigger question is, you know, do the polls really matter? In 2016, they didn't matter. And if Trump can bring out this, you know, silent majority, these people that are not engaged with traditional media and are not answering polls, if he can bring more of these people out of the woodwork the way he did in 2016, then, you know, who knows? He could definitely win this thing.
So just picking up a couple of things you said there, we know one thing's for certain, and that's market volatility, whether it's a correction due to a worldwide event, whether it's a coronavirus, whatever. So as an investor, our strategy almost needs to be removed from things that we can't control. And that could be, I invest X amount per month for the long term, and so be it, I'm an investor. So we can't control the world, but I think it's important to be aware of what's happening and why it's happening. So when we see a spike in the portfolio, oh, we know that's just because of that and the markets have factored this in or whatnot.
Yeah.
Now, just on the candidates themselves, I guess my view was you said that Trump pulled out these people out of the woodwork. A lot of what we see on social media, on TV and pop culture, it's really East or West Coast United States, which are blue states, and it's not that real America. And I think that's why people are shocked that, you know, Trump walks into office, because all we see on our TV and through social media is blue, basically, and
yeah,
all that stuff. So if you've spent some time in America, I've spent a lot of time in Ohio, Nebraska, you know, Texas, it's just a different beast than what you see on social media.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why it's kind of hard for me right here sitting on the northern beaches of Sydney to know what's going to happen, because certainly if you listen to the media, and even our US correspondent is pretty bullish on a Biden win. He still thinks that's, you know, going to happen, but he probably doesn't leave DC that much. As a good AFR correspondent, he's going to be on the East Coast talking to fund managers and economists most of the time, right?
Yeah.
And so, but I was in the heartland in the South, but the South is always Republican. But I was also in Pennsylvania and Ohio in 2016 when the vote happened. And I remember the moment that I realized that Clinton, I just didn't see how Clinton could win. And it was about 2 days before the vote. And I went to see Hillary Clinton speak in Cleveland, Ohio. And she had LeBron James with her. And you could not possibly imagine in the history of the state of Ohio a more popular or important public figure than LeBron James, right?
Totally.
And he was on the stump for Hillary, you know, speaking on her behalf in the hope that they will pull a crowd. And for context, Ohio is a must-win state. It's a bellwether state. It's one of the few states. And as you said, there is a real dichotomy in the United States, as there is increasingly here, between, you know, outer suburban and inner city voters, between, you know, rural and regional, between coastal and bush. So they have those same sort of dichotomies going on. There aren't that many states that that are swing states, and Ohio is the ultimate swing state.
Yeah, I've got a lot of friends in particularly around Columbus, and I spend you know, a month a year there. I've got photos of like people's front lawns, all the posters, all the Trump stuff. It's just so wild, which is weird because a lot of my friends think he's a dickhead like most of other people. So it's just wild. But do you think, and this is kind of, it's more of a question to you, like, did the Democratic Party wheel out Biden because they knew that Trump pulled out these, you know, porch and pool type middle class voters, that they would possibly swing across to the other porch and pools type guy anyway? Like,
yeah, well, that's the hope of Biden. So to go back to the people who Trump pulled out of the woodwork are very interesting. And as I was saying, so, you know, LeBron James is there, and she was only able to pull 2,000 people to this crowd with LeBron James there, right? There were more people down the road at the Cleveland Browns game, which are not a good team in the NFL, than there were at this rally. And then I got in the car and I drove to a place called Moon Township, Pennsylvania, which is about a 6-hour drive from there, where Trump was meant to be giving a speech in a hangar, an airport hangar. And there were 50,000 people in the line to see Trump in a battleground state. And this is when I knew that something was up here. And a lot of these people were working class people. You know, they were overwhelmingly white. They were a lot of people who hadn't voted before. And this is coal country, right? And so that's where Trump picked up a lot of votes. He picked them up partly because he was able to articulate a kind of anti-elite, anti-East Coast. I mean, he was able to, despite being a billionaire from Manhattan, somehow incredibly articulate the concerns of people who had felt left behind by the global financial system for the last 20 years. And he was able to paint Hillary Clinton as a, you know, as the type of person who flies into Davos on a helicopter, and hangs out with, you know, with royalty from Europe on her for fun, you know, and that does not play well in coal country. And so to go back to your question on Biden, yes, the Democrats are hoping that Biden is more competitive in these places, and he may be. Right, because he's from Scranton, Pennsylvania. He, you know, has that working class background. He has a son that was in the military. You know, he's not seen as a Clinton. But having said that, he has been a, you know, professional politician for 40 years. He is reasonably close with the Clintons. And I also wonder whether you know, average Americans, even though Biden has huge name recognition, he doesn't have name recognition to the extent of Trump or Clinton. And he's really just known as Obama's second in command, right? I wonder whether that story of his childhood and, you know, regular Joe from Scranton, from the suburbs, who kind of, you know, who's had personal tragedy in his life and has, you know, really made something of himself and the family man. I just wonder how much that is cutting through when you've got Trump dominating the airwaves and Trump dominating social media. You know, I just don't know if anyone who doesn't follow politics closely is hearing that. But you know, if he can claw back, the other problem he's got, of course, is energy policy. And just like the Labor Party in Australia, you know, the Democrats are super split. And, you know, this is why this issue of fracking, which is, you know, a big part of their energy sector over there and is really controversial. And that's a big industry in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio and the Appalachian Mountains. But he also needs to, you know, get all of the hardcore Democrats over the line, people in New England and New York City and California who don't want fracking and who want the Green New Deal, right? And so he hasn't done a great job of answering this question of what energy policy will look like because of this problem that he's got trying to reach these two constituencies. So, look, maybe and there's also a gender factor potentially, right? Maybe Joe will appeal more than Hillary Clinton did to some of these white collar, particularly white men, blue collar white men in these battleground states. But I don't know. I think Trump has done a pretty good job of painting him as just another politician.
Yeah. Now, and just on that, so Trump kind of came into power on this promise, I'm not a politician, I'm going to drain the swamp, blah, blah, blah. We've had 4 years. What is he selling this time? And what is Biden actually selling? Is Biden selling Trump's a dickhead and he's trashed the place and trashed our reputation? We need to get the country back on track. Is Trump, like, what is Trump selling and what is Biden selling this time around?
Yeah, it's a good question. Look, I think one of the big issues is, I guess, the virus, right? And so Biden has very clearly tried to make the virus the enemy. And he's been wearing masks since the very beginning of the campaign, and Trump ridiculed him for that. And Trump has been trying to simultaneously defend his record on the virus while also trying to maybe tap into this very American view that the virus is an overreaction, you know, the lockdowns are an overreaction to the pandemic by, you know, public health elites and the media elites that goes against a very American conception of freedom. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see who wins that fight. And arguably one of the reasons why the polls are now narrowing is I think Trump contracting, you know, COVID-19 and then bouncing out of it so quickly arguably helps that perception that there is an overreaction to the virus. Now there's this whole debate about whether maybe Melania Trump is a little bit more sick than they're letting on. She hasn't been seen in public, and then yesterday she was seen in public, and there's a whole Twitter firestorm over whether or not that was a body double and not actually Melania Trump. So, you know, this is some of the craziness that's out there, but all, you know, it's an election. So, you know, there's always a circus and it's plausible, right? But I do think that for those voters for whom lockdowns are, and you have to keep in mind, you know, there is a strong current in American society that is not just Republican. It's more Republican these days than not. But there is a strong foundational kind of libertarian streak in American politics. I write about this a lot in my book about the election, you know, that I wrote over there, USA G'day. And it's really deep. And if you look at a state like New Hampshire, right, which is seen as a relatively, it's a swing state, but it's a bit more blue. You know, it's on the coast. It's a lot of educated people live in New Hampshire. And their state motto that you see on the back of number plates is freedom or death, right? Live free or die. Now, that doesn't leave much room for government-mandated lockdowns, right? Yeah. If you subscribe to a view that freedom is preferable to death, or that death is preferable to a lack of freedom. And that kind of debate between kind of freedom and security is something that in places like Europe and maybe to a lesser extent Australia is not as front of mind. Although, you know, we have pockets of it in Western Australia, in Queensland. There are voters who for whom this freedom thing is really strong, but I don't think it's the same as over there.
Yeah. Now, so without COVID, what would Biden have? Would he have guns to campaign on? Like, what would his big thing be?
Well, I don't think guns is winning. I mean, look, the problem is you have to factor in that, like Australia and like most countries, most of the voting population, and remember, America is a voluntary voting country, and that's a big factor. Only about half the people vote. Mm-hmm. Now, most of those people are going to be one side or the other no matter what. Right. Yeah. And so the election comes down to what Americans call GOTV, get out the vote, right? Yeah. Who turns up on the day? And the Republicans always have an inbuilt advantage, which is why you're getting this whole debate around voter fraud and access to voting and how easy we should make it to vote. In a lot of Republican states, for example, they demand ID when you vote, which is very controversial because some people in lower socioeconomic brackets and homeless people and other people who have a right to vote but may not carry identification with them, that stops them from voting, and arguably they may be more likely to vote Democrat. But, you know, Republicans tend to turn up on the day. And that includes a large number of people who probably aren't huge Trump fans, who are upper middle class, who are bankers and lawyers and suburbanites and, you know, golf types, you know, your typical kind of suburban liberal voters in Australia. That's the base of the Republican Party. And a lot of those people are not huge Trump fans, but I really question whether they will switch to Joe Biden.
And I think that was my initial thoughts of at least Biden might be able to get 20% of those.
Maybe. But look, a lot of those people are not deeply engaged with this kind of raging culture war. You know, they don't care about issues like gay marriage and even the lockdowns, you know, because a lot of these wealthier people are able to withstand the lockdowns. They're working from home. They own vast properties. They're in their country retreats like a lot of rich people are in Australia right now, right?
Yeah.
So for them, it really, a lot of them vote on economic issues. And before the virus, you know, Trump had gotten the US economy into pretty good shape, arguably. So for them, you know, they vote on things like taxes and Trump's being clear on that. So that's not where the debate is. That's not where the election is won and lost.
And just on the taxes, one of your colleagues wrote an article how there's this big transfer of wealth happening in the States right now, because if people think Biden will get in, the whole inheritance tax, estate tax issue will come to fruition possibly. So there's a lot happening over there, yeah.
Yeah, and look, it's always very difficult in an election to find out exactly what particularly the Democrats' tax policies are, because it's their biggest weakness, arguably, particularly in the United States, where even people of relatively meager means who aren't wealthy often support the idea of fewer taxes, right? I mean, in places like Texas, income tax is unconstitutional, you've got to remember, right? So the idea that the government taxes by force for many Americans is a controversial idea, whereas in most countries, that's just the basic premise of society, right? So look, yeah, we'll see. I don't know if that's going to be the big clincher either. I think, you know, there's a few things. One is this kind of blue collar voter, and how many of those still turn out for Trump again. That's the one sort of group to be looking at. The other group to be watching is suburban wealthy women, right? And the extent to which they, who are normally Republicans, women who are normally Republicans, whose families and husbands traditionally vote Republican, whether they are so disgusted with Trump and his behavior and his rhetoric on women's issues now, whether they will switch to Biden. I'm not convinced that necessarily that will happen, but certainly that's, you know, a narrative that's out there, and that could be something that matters. And the other big one, Glenn, which is of relevance to your audience, is whether or not progressive millennials turn out for Joe Biden. And we know that they don't like Donald Trump. And, you know, every poll of that audience shows that they detest Donald Trump, and they tend to support Democratic ideals. But they didn't turn up in big numbers for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and that was a problem. And it remains to be seen whether they we know they don't like Trump, but will they turn up and vote for the first time, some of these kids? And that'll be a big issue as well.
And it's I've heard chatter online that if it is a Biden White House, that it will be a different type of Biden, because he can't be soft on foreign policy.
Yeah, interesting. And so when it comes to things like the China trade war, which arguably is one of the biggest policy issues that affects people who are active in markets, right? It isn't clear the extent to which they would be different. I mean, during this campaign and during the debates we've seen, when, you know, the debates haven't been crazy and we've actually gotten to some substantive sort of matter, they're not that different on China. They're kind of trying to out-hawk each other, and they're both talking tough on China. So it's not clear that that Biden would be too different there. And Trump, to be fair, has adopted a lot of traditionally Democrat policies when it comes to, you know, being protectionist, introducing tariffs, looking after primary industries and agriculture and manufacturing. I mean, these are kind of trade union issues, right? These are not your typical Wall Street Republican ideas of globalism and open markets, right? And going to the country where business conditions are most favorable.
And do you think, just a question there on Biden, Kamala Harris, do you think there is a chance that the Democratic Party have installed Biden in a similar way that Bush was installed and Dick Cheney running the show?
Yeah, look, I don't know if I agree with the premise there with Bush and Cheney. I think that's
I mean, it was a great movie.
Narrative.
If you haven't
seen
Vice.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And look, and there's elements of that that would be true, because, you know, George Bush would be the first to say he wasn't a super political guy or a super strategic guy when it came to the politics. So he surrounded himself by people who he did, you know, listen to their advice a lot. Trump, certainly not someone who listens to advice a lot from his people. So
can you believe how much he trashes Fucci?
Yeah, I know. Unbelievable. Yeah, his own infectious diseases. Maybe that plays to him, to his base, right? I mean, he has these punching bags around him, and every time he attacks Fauci, who to be fair, is one of the, you know, top infectious diseases doctors in the world, maybe he looks like he's beating up on the global elites. You know, maybe it plays right into his wheelhouse. But in terms of the Biden Kamala Harris things, look, there are whispers that there is maybe a bit of a deal. I mean, don't forget that Joe Biden is super old, right? Like, he's well into his 70s. He will be older if he takes office in January than Ronald Reagan was when Ronald Reagan left the White House as the oldest president we've ever had. So there are talks that maybe he would only do one term and he would hand over to Kamala Harris. But again, like energy policy, that's something that is a bit dangerous for him and that he wouldn't want to talk about too much, because the young progressives who love Kamala Harris, they're going to be really enthused about that. But in Pennsylvania, they may not be too excited about a progressive woman from San Francisco who isn't super keen on the coal industry and has a pretty clear record on green policies. They're not going to be keen about the idea of Joe handing over to her, right? So you're not getting a clear picture from them on that. You know, that remains to be seen. They still got to win first, and I think that's far from in the bag.
And just I guess wrapping up this type of political chat. How is it simplistically explained to people? So, for example, in your local electorate in Australia, you don't actually vote for the Prime Minister, you vote for a member, and if that member happens to be Prime Minister, well, that's cute. But you can basically, is it first past the post in the States, like anyone anywhere can vote for Trump, vote for Biden?
Yeah, so look, it's super complex, to be honest. So, for example, in 2016, Trump lost the popular vote, as we know, by a few million votes and ended up winning the election. And that's because of the Electoral College system, which is different, again, to our system, which is a Westminster system where you vote for your local member, or you vote for the candidate that the local party has put up. And different to the UK system, which is a pure first past the post at a federal level. The Electoral College system is complex, and it is state by state system. So even though when you go into the voting booth, it will literally say on the ballot, it'll say Trump Pence for the Republicans. It'll say Biden Harris for the Democrats. And it will say a collection of smaller candidates, not Kanye, unfortunately, because he missed the deadline.
Yeah,
that's right, and that's a whole nother. You know, you have a whole podcast.
Oh man, have you listened to him on Joe Rogan's podcast over the weekend?
I haven't seen that. Oh, no, he's got some fresh stuff. So, well, he's still clinging on, is he? Or
he's still running. Don't worry about that.
yeah. So, look, had he been on the ballot, though, to be fair, that could have been a game changer potentially. I mean, the argument there is that it could have split the Democratic vote. Perhaps the African American community, which where Biden is polling very, very well, perhaps some of the younger members of that community, and just generally younger Americans and fans of Kanye, which is not a small voting group, right? May have voted for him, and that could have made a difference. But you will get in some states the Libertarian Party, which is a minor party, and the Green Party, which is another minor party on the left. They all appear on the ballot, but they get very, very few votes. So even though you think you're voting for those tickets, you are actually voting for a set of electors or delegates from the party in each state. So in that sense, it's not that different to what we have, where you're voting for a local guy putting his hand up for office. The only difference is those delegates that you're voting for in the in each of the American states have pledged themselves to one of the tickets, and so basically they tally up these electoral college votes. And in I think almost all of the states, if not all of the states, they then have a winner takes all arrangement for those electoral college votes. So look. It's complex. Politics is complex. At the end of the day, there's a certain level of votes at which it's truly decisive, right? And if we don't get to those, and because of the pandemic and because of the mail-in votes, there's a very real chance we won't get there on the night. That could trigger a whole range of potentially problematic legal disputes. Each state doesn't have the exact same voting process. And so we saw that was a major problem in 2000, where the election was contested and did go to the Supreme Court, for example. And they were questioning the validity of so-called hanging chads in the state of Florida, where you actually have a punch card system, like a physical punch card. And there was a big fight over whether or not you should count the votes if there was a little bit of paper still hanging or not. So, and that was decisive in the end. You know, Bush ended up, taking that election after the Supreme Court found in his favor. But crucially, that didn't happen automatically. That only happened in the year 2000 when Al Gore, the Democratic candidate and Bill Clinton's vice president, where he actually fell on his sword and said, look, I don't think this is right. I think they've played dirty games, but the Supreme Court has said what they've said. And in the interests of the country, I concede, right? Mm-hmm. That's what normally happens. Now, I can't see Donald Trump doing that under any circumstances. I don't know about you, but so look, we may be in for a big legal dispute here. But I also think that there is a bit of doomsdaying going on with this stuff. You know, people think that, and I've spent a lot of time in the developing world in my early career in West Africa, and I've, you know, looked at elections in these sort of countries, and there is a really, you know, the peaceful transfer of power is one of the most important things we have as, you know, in democratic countries, and you can't take that for granted. I mean, in terms of investors, it's crucial that we get this democratic transfer of power and this peaceful transfer of power. And in African countries, for example, this is what happens. They might have a vote that is legitimate, but then, you know, if the government in power and the regime in power decides not to hand that baton over, sometimes you can't make them. Now, the prospect of that happening in the United States is almost nil, right? Mm. If Donald Trump does try to have a hissy fit and act like a dictator and barricade himself inside the White House with his own personal secret service, they will go in there and they will arrest him and there will be a transfer of power because, you know, at the end of the day, the American Constitution is a more powerful document than Donald Trump is powerful.
Yeah,
that's right. And so I think all investors and all people who are watching this, no matter how crazy it should seem, in my view, should take comfort from that. And that's why, at the end of the day, a lot of the normal processes are in play here, right? And ultimately, I think what will happen was will most likely Donald Trump will win because that's what usually happens. You know, a Republican has a second term, and then after that, it will go back to Democrats for 8 years. And so, in terms of the macro picture, it is fun to get really into the weeds because, you know, it's a very spicy election cycle, and it's you know, a lot of people's lives are always affected depending on the outcome. But ultimately, you know, looking at the macro picture, I think history is a pretty good guide.
And just, a final comment that isn't really relevant to anyone, but I think it's fun to have a chat about. The first debate, do you agree that sucked more because the moderator sucked?
Look, did it suck more? Look, it sucked more because maybe they brought in a new rule for the second debate.
Yeah, the microphone.
Where they had the mute function and that seemed to have worked better, but I don't think it was just the mute function. Donald Trump clearly changed his approach and his strategy in the second debate.
Oh, he was so much more measured and considered, wasn't he?
Yeah, exactly. And he was less belligerent. So, but I don't know if that was him listening to feedback or if he just felt different today. You know, he's pretty emotionally motivated. Mm. I also wonder whether debates really matter. You know, I mean, they matter a lot to people who follow Twitter and people who are deeply engaged in the mainstream media. And a lot of investors, for example, are those people who are engaging with this. But I don't know if that matters. I mean, there's very, very few Americans who have not made up their mind about these two people, right? So does a debate shift votes? I don't really think so.
Yeah, well, there you go, everyone. There's a... it's just interesting nevertheless. And, you know, it is somewhat material to us who's in the White House because, you know, they're an ally. They're the world's largest democracy. And, yeah, it's just very interesting to see what happens. Now, Alex, you're a wealth editor at the AFR.
Mm.
What's the go with this tech fang boom that's happening in the States? Is that going to cool off?
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting one. And that's one where I think we're not getting a whole lot of policy debate at this election, but I do think that that's going to be a policy area that either president, whoever wins, is going to really tackle in their second term. And if Trump wins in particular, you've got to remember that they've got set terms in America, right? So they can only do 8 years max. And traditionally, the president does things in their second term that they wouldn't have ever done in their first term.
That's right, because they can go down with the ship in the second term.
And they get courageous, right? They do stuff that might not be vote winning, but that helps shore up their legacy.
Yeah.
Obama had all sorts of stuff planned on the global stage, but, you know, he wasn't able to get to a lot of that. But I do think one issue that is going to become major for either candidate in the next 4 years is going to be the regulation of the tech giants. And I think, you know, Europe is really leading this at the moment because it's awkward for Americans, you know, because I think people are really of two minds about this. And certainly for me as someone who is a journalist but also fairly pro-innovation, you know, I'm of two minds about this. You know, on the one hand, I can see the toxic culture that social media kind of at least enables. But to what extent is that is that their fault? And to what extent should we be considering them traditional media, and what responsibility do they have for the content on their platforms? You know, this is a major, major policy issue that has never been dealt with before, and that affects pretty much every person's life, right? Certainly every person who's connected to the internet in globally, this affects their daily life. So I think that's going to be a big one. And obviously that's going to have an impact on specific equities and specific stocks, depending on whether they're winners and losers of this regulatory regime when it comes.
I tell you what I found fascinating, just one kind of a couple of one-liners that Trump said, just kind of back to that thinking, you know, second term. I'm loosely paraphrasing. Did Trump pretty much say Obamacare, it's pretty good, but like he almost conceded that Obamacare, you did a good job, but I've kind of tweaked the edges and I'll make it even better, which I thought very irregular that he'd give any homage to that.
But again, I mean, he says things like that and then does it hurt? I mean, you remember it. You know, yeah, nobody who's listening to this votes in the US, or at least very few, if any.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think he did. I mean, what he, you know, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, in the rhetoric, he likes to dismantle it, but then there's also elements to which he's keeping it, you know, in largely in play. Interestingly, he also, I mean, I guess the big difference is he is very keen to stress that there are, you know, all sorts of, you know, millions of private healthcare holders whose policies won't be affected under Trump care. And that's obviously, he thinks, a winning argument for him. And Biden is talking about tweaking it, you know, as well to introduce Biden care. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, when it comes to the policy stuff, and for anyone who's looking at this sort of thing and then trying to get an angle on a particular healthcare stock or whatever, you know, that's not a bad way to be thinking. But you got to remember that it's very difficult to pass laws in that country. And just because a certain – and they're not even in Congress, right?
It's, I was going like to say, and we haven't even touched on Congress in this bloody chat.
Yeah, that's right. And so they don't. Yeah, so there's another race going on that doesn't get anywhere near the amount of airtime. But you know, the Senate and the House are also up for re-election, and so that's a big deal in terms of how laws actually get passed. But no matter what happens, it's very difficult to pass laws in the United States. That's the way that the founding fathers intended it, because they do have that kind of knee-jerk anti-government streak, and they didn't want it to be easy for administrations to just ram through their agenda. And it's certainly not easy in the United States, and the size of the lobbying industry makes it more difficult, and all of the vested interests and just the size of their government and the size of their nation makes it difficult. So, you know, just because one side wins certainly doesn't mean that their policies come into place, because if that was the case, we'd have a big-ass wall right now, wouldn't we?
Yeah, totally. There you go. Everyone, head over to the AFR and check out Wealth Generation, and also subscribe to the AFR. I mean, I've got the app. It's a couple of dollars a month, whatever that is, and it's just a good source of information. You've got people like Alex in there who are on the ground writing concise articles, if you will. A piece, as they call them in the journalist world.
Yeah, yeah. I don't write too much about Trump these days, so it's nice to nice to reflect. We've got someone on the ground who does that and giving you you know, an actual snapshot of what's happening there. No, but it was great to chat, mate.
No worries, and we'll have you on again soon.
Absolutely, good stuff.
We acknowledge the Darkin Young people, traditional custodians of the land on which our studio sits, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. We extend that respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who may listen to our podcast.
My Millennial Money supports A21, a charity focused on abolishing slavery and human trafficking all over the world. Check out a21.org.au for more info. If you would like some other giving options, or if you're unsure about which charity you can support, head to thelifeyoucansave.org.au.
If you're looking for a super fund that puts its members' interests above all else, choose a super performer, Sun Super. With low fees, strong investment returns, and great member services, Sun Super is Super Ratings 2020 Fund of the Year, and has also been awarded by Money Magazine, Canstar, and Finder. Find out more at sunsuper.com.au/M3. You can join Sun Super online in under 5 minutes. This podcast is for education and entertainment purposes. Any advice is general financial advice only, which does not take into account your objectives, financial situation, or needs. Because of that, you should consider if the advice is appropriate to you and your needs before acting on the information. If you do choose to buy a financial product, read the product disclosure statement and obtain appropriate financial advice tailored to your needs. Symo Interactive Proprietary Limited, the publisher of the podcast, is an authorised representative of Money Sherpa Proprietary Limited, which holds financial services license 451-289.